We are getting our guest on the line. All right, our guest is Michael Clare, who's a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And some of his books are Rising Power, Shrinking Planet. Earlier, he wrote a book, Blood and Oil. Michael Clare, are you there?
I sure am.
Oh, welcome to KBOO.
My pleasure. Good morning to you out there in Oregon.
Well, how's the weather there? Our weather's kind of warming up a little bit.
Oh, I wish I was there. It's cold. We had snow yesterday.
Oh, no. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit. Now, your article, it's on the Tomgram, tomdispatch.com, and it's Another Planet for James Cameron, and you talk about his big blockbuster movie, Avatar. Why don't we go a little bit into that? You know, for people who haven't seen it yet, what's Avatar about?
Well, because many of your listeners have seen it, but Avatar is basically about an effort by a giant multinational mining corporation to plunder a very exotic resource called unobtainium on the planet of Pandora. And like many such ventures in the planet Earth, this is in a jungle-like setting inhabited by indigenous people who resist the plunder of their natural resources by fighting back, you know, basically with bows and arrows and other traditional weapons. And a rebel from a turncoat from the Marines that are protecting the mining company, Jake Scully, joins the native people in resisting the corporation.
Well, now, Pandora, Greek mythology, didn't Pandora have a box that once it was opened, all the ills of the world kind of swarmed out?
Yeah.
I wonder if there's any connection with the movie in that.
Well, I'm sure that James Cameron had something like that in mind.
Okay, and then you, what I found really interesting is you sort of wrote that in case, not a sequel, but a prequel, sort of the events leading up to the state of the world in, I guess, 2154. And so it's like a scenario of sort of downfall of the empire. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, sure. What the hints that you get in the movie Avatar is that the Earth, our planet, has been thoroughly depleted of all its vital natural resources, and global warming has made it, depleted and turned brown. All the green has been burned away, and it's kind of uninhabitable. There's a lot of fighting going on for what's left of vital resources, so the corporations have to go to other planets in order to get minerals and whatever else you need for industrial civilization. So I try to picture what it would be like on Earth in the decades before the corporations are forced to look elsewhere for these resources. And I picture a planet in which there's constant warfare between the remaining large industrial centers for the remaining supplies, whatever is left of oil, of iron and copper and the like, water and food. And I imagine that years from now, there's going to be a lot less of those things and a lot more warfare. I should say I wrote a book called Resource Wars about 10 years ago that talks about wars in contemporary times over vital resources.
Well, you know, you also wrote an article, I guess about a year ago, called No Oil for War, which I thought was really interesting. It, basically said that, militaries depend so much on cheap oil, you know, for their armored vehicles and helicopters and everything else that, as the oil gets more expensive, this is going to change warfare.
Indeed. And this year, for the first time, the Department of Defense is openly talking about its dependence on oil to fight its wars. This is in the new Pentagon strategy document called the Quadrennial Defense Review, or the QDR, came out on February 1st, and they openly speak about their vulnerability to oil shortages and oil disruptions and the need to rethink their long-term strategy from that point of view, to think about developing alternatives, renewable sources of energy. Because up until now, the Pentagon business model has been to procure ever more sophisticated weapons. That this is the Donald Rumsfeld plan, replace soldiers with ever more sophisticated fighter planes, but they use 10 times more oil than the ones they replace, ditto for tanks and missiles and everything else. Well, that's an unsustainable mode of warfare, and now the Pentagon is coming face to face with the consequences of that.
Would you say that the Pentagon is more forward-looking than the rest of the government, or am I going too far with that?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that the Pentagon can move more swiftly than our Congress can. Mm-hmm. Our Congress can't seem to be able to move at all. The Pentagon is now saying that, yes, they will have to reconfigure their aircraft. The Air Force is saying that we now have to be able to fly our planes with non-petroleum fuels, and we have to be able to start doing that. So in that sense, they're ahead of the U.S. government as a whole.
Well, that makes me wonder, in 2144, these three power blocks are fighting for diminishing resources, and what do they fight with?
Well, I wonder about that myself. Because James Cameron, in his movie, sets this a century or so into the future, but it looks like the big machines he uses in the war scenes look a lot like today's war machines, and those are powered by petroleum. So I personally don't believe there will be any petroleum left a century from now. I think it'll all be gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't seem to be powered by solar batteries, solar cells. So it's very unclear what is going to power those war machines that he shows in his movie. But for the sake of argument, I say in my prequel scenario that there'll still be a little bit of oil left, but it will all be monopolized by the military.
But wouldn't that arouse a lot of political opposition? I mean, if people are freezing in their homes while the Pentagon is sending aircraft and tanks around the world, you'd think there'd be opposition to that.
Well, you would think so, but I think that's the path we're on today, quite mm-hmm. frankly. I think we're moving into a world where oil, like other things, will be increasingly expensive, and ordinary citizens are going to, be forced, not by rationing, but by the marketplace, to use less and less. And for some people, that's going to create a lot of real hardships, and the rest of us are going to have to redesign our lifestyle in many ways to accommodate to that, ride bicycles and take public transportation. We're not going to have much of a choice in the matter.
You don't think that the government might have some kind of rationing, where the farms and the emergency services and things get, the first choice, but there's enough oil left over so that people can get ration cards, say for, say 10 gallons a week at a reasonable price, and everything else they pay market price for, and these cards can be sold or transferred.
That's a realistic future. I can see the day when that comes.
Mm-hmm.
Something will have to give, because the demand for oil is going to grow astronomically as Chinese citizens and consumers and Indian and Brazilian consumers aspire to duplicate the lifestyle that we have, where everybody owns an automobile or an SUV mm-hmm. powered by petroleum, and the supply of oil is going to start diminishing. So there's going to be intense competition in the marketplace for a diminishing supply, And historically, the United States has taken off the top one-fourth, 25% of world's oil every day goes to the United States. That's mm-hmm. not going to be sustainable either. So there'll be a lot more stress, international stress, over the supply of oil. And that's why in my scenario, my prequel for Avatar, I talk about a future in which, you know, 100 years from now, there are three great blocks, a North American bloc, a Chinese bloc, and a Russian-German bloc, fighting with each other constantly to get their hands on whatever little supply of oil is left in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would you hazard a guess as to when this sort of peak oil may happen? Or
I think that people need to understand that peak oil, the maximum sustainable daily rate of production, has already come and gone mm-hmm. for conventional liquid oil, the kind of stuff that comes gushing out of the ground. In another movie people may have seen, There Will Be Blood, where you see a gusher.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you only talk about that, what's called conventional oil comes from the ground in a liquid, we've passed the peak of that. I think that more and more of our petroleum is now coming from unconventional oil, from Canadian tar sands, from shale oil, from biofuels, from ethanol, from deep offshore oil and Arctic oil, and that'll give us another 10 years maybe before the peak of all of these forms mm-hmm. of petroleum.
But with this kind of oil, it may use up the energy it takes to get that oil may almost be as much as the oil you get.
That's exactly right. So
the net,
like I say, that point may be reached. I believe it will be reached in this decade, the second mm-hmm. decade of the 21st century. And after that, after 2020, it'll be a downhill march.
I've heard all kinds of guesses. I don't know. Anyway, so you have these three powers. You have the North American Federation, and this has happened after the U.S. has invaded Canada. And then you have Greater China, which includes Siberia, and then the North European Alliance, which includes kind of western part of Russia. The Greater China, including Siberia, there's demographics that the Russian population is really declining, especially in the eastern Siberia, where the Chinese population, is still going up. And I can see a scenario where Chinese men marry Russian women and the Russian guys just kind of go off drinking or something.
Well, they're dying at an ever-increasing rate. I mean, that is to say the mortality of men in China, in Russia, is the average age of mortality for men is declining in Russia because of ill health.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's any possibility that China and Russia, right now this is the big fear apparently of the U.S. establishment, that China and Russia, they have the Shanghai Cooperation mm-hmm. Organization, and that China and Russia and these other nations in Central Asia will kind of form an alliance. They may haggle over this and that, but they'll stand together.
I sometimes think that that's possible. I think that will only happen if the United States pushes them into an embrace.
Mm-hmm.
I think if left to themselves, they would rather go their own way. I think the current Russian leadership, Putin and Medvedev, I think they would rather join with Europe, because Europe is their biggest customers. So in my scenario, I see a Russian-German alliance, because now with the Nord Stream pipeline beginning construction,
mm-hmm.
this is a joint Russian-German natural gas pipeline, which will bypass Ukraine and the Baltic states. The two countries are becoming increasingly economically united. I think that's the way that Russia would prefer to go, rather than an alliance with China.
Well, they are sending some of their oil to China. And it's,
yes.
What about the possibility that Europe may become kind of an appendage to this greater Central Asian organization?
Well, this is a plausible scenario, of course.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more likely, though, that China will absorb Siberia, eastern Siberia, for the reasons you were saying, that the Russian population there is in decline and the Chinese population is growing, that they'll simply absorb Siberia and the Koreas and form a greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere like the Japanese dreamed of, that's the way that will go. And Europe and Russia will form together and exploit the Arctic and Africa, and the United States will become increasingly focused on the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. Well, then you go into global warming, and in your scenario, well, the global South is basically uninhabitable, which it seems to me would lead to huge migrations and wars. Coastal areas are underwater. This would include Florida and, I guess, parts of the Gulf Coast. Hey, maybe even Washington, D.C. You know, that's not too far above water.
Nope.
And then, raw materials would be very scarce. And then you say people would starve if not for genetically modified crops from big corporate farms. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, now, I want your listeners to understand this is just a scenario.
Right,
It's a movie scenario.
A good guess.
I'm not saying all these things are destined to happen. I hope that people, take action long before these dreadful things occur. Let's just make sure our listeners understand
that. Well, sure. The scenario is a plausible guess about the future.
Exactly.
With evidence and whatever.
If the worst effects of global warming occur and we do nothing to alter our trajectory that we're currently on, it is very likely that the sea level will rise by 10 feet or more, and that'll flood much of Florida, as you say, the Gulf Coast, Boston, New York City, Charleston, Baltimore, and some West Coast cities as well. Much of Bangladesh, the Philippines, Vietnam, low-lying coastal areas, about a tenth of the world's population lives within 10 feet of the ocean, and a lot of food production, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this will be massively catastrophic. And at the same time, large areas of interiors of continents cut off from rainfall, like the middle of the United States, will become dust bowls, desert.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, areas further north will become warmer. So it'll be Canada, that areas that are now can grow crops only for 2 months a year will have a much longer growing season. So they'll be able to grow more food, northern Canada and northern Scandinavia. So those will become the desirable areas, which is why I predict that at some point the United States will have to abandon its southern half. The southern states will become uninhabitable in this scenario. And so the U.S. will invade and occupy Canada to get its lands, which are now not worth very much, will become much more desirable when the planet is hotter.
Well, that sounds like quite a war right there. I think the Canadians would just roll over.
Canada, like you were talking about Siberia before, is sparsely populated, and most of Canada is as well. Mm-hmm. Now, I hope any Canadians who are listening understand I'm not saying this is desirable or will happen. I'm just saying this is a movie scenario.
Right. We're not advocating, but we're giving a warning.
We're giving a warning.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about these GM crops? I mean, it's, there are people in the permaculture movement say that actually permaculture could feed everybody in the world.
I understand all this. I'm projecting in this scenario that to feed people and in a time when half the planet has become that now grows crops becomes desert, you're going to have to produce crops that can grow in conditions that are extremely severe, that are salt tolerant, that are drought tolerant. So you're gonna invent new, you know, biotech invented crops that can essentially grow in desert-like conditions, so or hydroponic farms and that sort of thing, to feed people. And you know, if you have the money, you'll be able to afford that, and the rest of the population will starve.
Mm-hmm. Well, these corporate farms would need quite a lot of fuel for the machines and, you know, the pesticides and stuff. I don't know. I work on these scenarios, too. In mine, I think parts of the U.S. may resort to prison farms.
Well, that's not beyond the pale either. All of these are, I believe, plausible scenarios if we don't take action to reverse the kinds of behavior that's making climate change more likely, extreme climate change more likely, and we don't take steps to conserve the remaining supply of oil and other vital resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you also go in a couple wars like the U.S. fighting China in Venezuela. That's an interesting one. Of course, everybody fighting in Nigeria. You know, right now there's a thing going on where some of these Middle Eastern, kind of like Saudi Arabia, you know, they don't have any farmland themselves, so they're kind of trying to buy up farmland in Africa.
That's absolutely right.
And I wonder if they'll be able to succeed. I think if things come to a crunch, you know, they may not be able to hang on to those farms.
And that's a good point. Yes, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, United Arab Emirates are buying up fertile land in places like Sudan and Ethiopia and walling it off from the rest of the population, and bringing in corporate-type farming methods so that they have an assured food supply in the future when everything is much tougher. Now, whether they're looking at rainfall, future rainfall projections for those areas or not, I just can't say.
Mm-hmm. Well, it brought down a government in Madagascar not too long ago.
That's right.
I think there was a Korea. I think Korea.
Korea. South Koreans. Yep.
Well, we got a few minutes left, so what do you think we should do about this now to prevent this from happening?
Well, I think that sustainability has to become like the national religion. We all have to become aware that the kind of lifestyle that we've been accustomed to, which assumes that resources like water and land and petroleum are super abundant and will be ever more so in the future, that those days are now over forever, and that we have to redesign our living behavior to conserve those things. They're precious, and we want to make sure there's enough left over for our children and grandchildren. So it's essential that we conserve them and use them prudently. Now, I take my hat off to you folks in Portland, because you've thought about this much better than most people in this country. You've restrained sprawl. You have a good public transit system. You favor bicycles. We need to do a lot more of that in the rest of the country.
Well, here in Portland, a few years back, they had a peak oil task force, and they wrote up a report which was accepted by the city council, and you know, they went into, you know, scenarios of the future and what could be done. And it should be official policy. I'm not sure how well they keep on doing this, but, you know, this was an attempt. And, of course, there are other cities around. Willits, California comes to mind. I think they've gone even further than Portland. Of course, it's a smaller place.
Yeah. Well, I also know that the United States is falling behind much of the rest of the industrial world and China in developing railroads. We're going to need railroads, high-speed rail, in the future as petroleum becomes more scarce. And that's something we need to promote, too.
What about just ordinary railroads? You know, like Sam Smith, who writes a Progressive Review, says that, you know, high speed is great, but it requires such an infrastructure where it'd be better just to, fix our existing rail lines, which actually cover the country, and just have ordinary trains like they used to.
Well, that would be a good step. Mm-hmm. That would be a good first step. You want the high-speed rail because our country is vast, and you want to get people out of aircraft as
right.
well as out of cars, because aircraft are also big consumers, gas guzzlers.
Oh, you bet,
well.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're going to have to end it there. This is really a fascinating article. You can get it on tomdispatch.com. And we've been talking with Michael Clare, who is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, author of Rising Power, Shrinking Planet, and her previous book was Blood and Oil. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Been my pleasure.
Okay, this has been Fight the Empire, and we've been talking about the possible futures of the empire. And now stay tuned for Air Cascadia.